From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Adam Smith, a Democrat from the western state of Washington. And we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. Congressman Adam Smith is serving his 10th term in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber of the U.S. Congress. He is the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee, where he is a strong advocate for U.S. military personnel and their families. Previously, he chaired the Terrorism, Unconventional Threats and Capabilities Subcommittee, which oversees the United States Special Operations Forces and counterterrorism policy. Congressman Smith has also served on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Congressman Smith is also dedicated to comprehensive immigration reform, supporting President Barack Obama's executive actions on immigration. He also supports the expansion of global trade and has introduced legislation to help American workers who have lost their jobs to overseas competition. Congressman Smith also created the bipartisan Congressional Caucus for Effective Foreign Assistance, where he advocates for American foreign assistance reform to better utilize our resources to fight global poverty. Congressman Adam Smith, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back with you.
We spoke with you several years ago, and we're delighted you could join us again. And I'm also delighted to welcome my colleague, Catherine Gibson, our new VOA Congressional Correspondent. Well, Congressman Smith, first let me ask you a general question.
Sure.
What do you think is the greatest threat to U.S. national security today?
It continues to be the threat from violent extremist groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh. I don't like to call them ISIS or ISIL or give them that. Those terrorist groups that adhere to that ideology that grew out of Osama bin Laden, I think continues to be the greatest threat. Now, regrettably, there is a lot of competition for that. Russia certainly is a growing problem. North Korea, Iran, and China are all areas that we need to worry about. But the number one threat is those terrorist groups. Those are the groups that wake up every day, and the only thing stopping them from killing as many Americans as they can is their inability to do so. It is not a lack of will. So that continues to be, I think, the greatest threat and the one we need to be most focused on.
Oh, I want to follow up with you on that, but first let me turn to Afghanistan. We're continuing to see a threat from the Taliban, and we have a question from our Afghan service, and that is about the Haqqani Network and Taliban Shura, which is sometimes referred to as the Taliban shadow government. They have their bases in Pakistan, as you know,
right.
And the Pakistani military and the ISI intelligence agency are allegedly using them as their proxies in Afghanistan, and they're posing a threat to U.S. interests in Afghanistan and to the stability of that country. What possible and tangible actions are on the table, in your view, for the United States to prevent Pakistan from harboring Haqqani Network and Taliban on Pakistani soil?
It's a continuing struggle. Pakistan has sort of played this double game for a long time. Now, I will say recently, you know, there have been so many terrorist attacks in the last few years within Pakistan, and the lines are very much blurred between the Taliban that are, you know, attacking in Pakistan, the Taliban that are attacking in Afghanistan. So trying to convince Pakistan that it's in their self-interest to confront it as a whole. Also, it helps a great deal that Karzai is no longer president. Karzai had a very problematic relationship with Pakistan. The new president, you know, is much, you know, they have a much better working relationship, but it's always going to be a challenge because the ties are so deep between some of these groups and the Pakistani military and the Pakistani ISI. That we're going to have to continue to put pressure on them to try to make them see that a threat to Afghanistan is a threat to Pakistan. But I'm not going to pretend that there's an easy solution to that.
Now back to the threat from so-called ISIS, as you call them, Daesh, as many do. In order to counter that threat, we're seeing, you know, more and more U.S. troops, President Obama calls them advisors, special operations forces in advisory capacity, but more and more we're seeing them in a combat role, or at least the two are somewhat blurred.
Right.
How do you see this going forward, just at a time when President Obama, of course, wanted to begin, you know, withdrawing more, and because of the threat from Daesh, you know, we're seeing more and more special operations forces, whether in Syria, perhaps Libya, Yemen, and so forth?
Well, I think, you know, he's right. It has to be a supporting role, because ultimately to be successful in Iraq and in Syria, it's going to take domestic forces. I mean, we spent, you know, a decade, thousands of lives, and at its peak, I think, had about 180,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. Western troops will not pacify Iraq. We need locals, particularly Sunnis, who are willing to fight against Daesh. So we have to support them, train them, and work with them. But it cannot be a U.S.-dominated fight. The support the advisors give, the backup they give on certain combat missions, certain special forces raids for high-value targets, that kind of thing is going to go on. But it's going to have to be a locally led fight. And the greatest challenge there continues to be the Baghdad government, a Baghdad government that has just shoved the Sunnis out and into the arms of Daesh. So that's going to continue to be the greatest hurdle. If we could get a truly inclusive government in Baghdad, I think that would, you know, go a long way towards undermining the support for Daesh, but we're not there. Because of the influence of Shia extremists, because of the influence of Iran, too many Sunnis still don't believe, and rightly so, that they have a home in Iraq.
Well, just a quick follow-up on that. You articulated the problem very clearly. We see Iran playing a much greater role now in Iraq. In fact, probably they're much more influential than the United States, using
Certainly.
These Shia proxies who perhaps are, you know, useful in a very narrow sense in terms of combating Daesh, but at the
Right.
same time they're antagonizing the Sunni, and they are preventing the very reforms, the political reforms, which are needed for long-term stability.
Absolutely.
What do we do?
Well, first of all, I have no illusions about our ability to solve every problem. What we do is what we've been doing, is to continue to put pressure on Baghdad, continue to, you know, I think the relationship with Iran through the JCPOA, look, it's not ultimately, I believe, in Iran's best interests to have an ongoing, nonstop civil war throughout the region. They are losing lives in Iraq, in Syria, and in Yemen. Peace and stability is ultimately going to be in their best interests, and they don't want to empower Daesh. But that's exactly what they're doing by forcing the Baghdad government, or working with the Baghdad government, which is only too willing to try to make it a sectarian Shia government. So it's a matter of continuing to push that diplomatic argument while at the same time providing the firepower to try to contain the problem. And until we can get to that diplomatic solution, that's all we're going to be able to do. Until we get to the point where Sunnis have an alternative to Daesh, then we're going to continue to have that problem. So you got to work both sides of it.
A very quick follow-up. I had some panelists on a program on the Iraq political crisis recently.
Yeah.
And one of them said, you know, Iran has no compunction about talking to their members of parliament that are close with them, Shia members. And the United States, she thinks, should be doing the same thing, lobbying these parliamentarians who are really obstructing these reforms, because even Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is hamstrung. You know, he would like to go forward, but he's weak.
Right.
So do you think the United States should put more political pressure, be more on the ground, not physically, but using the same tactics, political tactics, as the Iranians?
I mean, diplomatically, I know Secretary Kerry is very committed to this, but I think, yes, that needs to be, you know, a huge pressure point. And like I said, part of it also is to get a greater sense of enlightened self-interest in the Iranians themselves. Because this, I mean, I don't see how this is in Iran's interest to have, you know, so many wars to fight in their neighborhood. So, but yes, absolutely, we should be more engaged diplomatically.
We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
Next time on Street Talk Africa, we'll discuss whether there's a need for a fundamental change in U.S.-Africa relations. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss U.S.-Africa relations next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. We're talking with Congressman Adam Smith, Democrat from the state of Washington and ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee. And now I'd like to turn to my colleague Catherine Gibson for a question.
Our international audience is fascinated by the way that lesbian and gay and transgender rights have really come to the forefront of political discussion lately. And I'd particularly like to look at the 2017 defense authorization, which has an amendment attached to it, the Russell Amendment, which you've argued violates lesbian and gay and transgender rights. Well, its supporters argue that it's a protection of religious freedom. Why isn't it protecting religious freedom? Why should
Well, first of all, it's very broad, and it says that, well, this is all in reaction to an executive order from the president. Right. The president issued an executive order saying that you cannot discriminate against the LGBT community and get contracts with the federal government, mm-hmm. not just DOD, but this way. And this, now in his executive order, he had an exception for specific religious organizations. This amendment expands that exception so that basically swallows everything up. And, you know, any contractor can claim, you know, a religious reason for discriminating.
Any private contractor, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So it's a license to discriminate against the LGBT community. And I stand strongly with the president to stop that discrimination in any way we can. And we shouldn't be doing business with businesses that discriminate.
How do you see that playing out in the House as you move forward with the defense authorization?
There's going to be a bipartisan amendment to pull it. And we'll see how that vote goes on the floor, and then we'll deal with it in conference. But if that's part of the bill, it probably gets the bill vetoed.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Congressman Adam Smith, a Democrat from the state of Washington. He is also the ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. If you have feedback, please send it to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Congressman Smith, you brought up in your answer to our first question about the threats that the United States faces in the world, as a matter of fact, Iran. So I wanted to pursue that with you and talk about the Iran nuclear deal. I know you voted in favor of it, but many who were both either for or against the deal are not so much critical of the deal itself, but rather the fact that it legitimizes a state which sponsors terrorism, either directly or through Shia militia proxies such as Hezbollah. We see that in Syria and Israel. And critics say the Obama administration could have and perhaps should have more aggressively pushed back on Iran's destabilizing activities, even as it was negotiating the nuclear deal, especially since the White House insisted that no other issue would affect nuclear negotiations. For example, while the negotiations were going on, Iran did nothing to reduce its aggressive and destabilizing activities, especially inside Syria, on behalf of Bashar al-Assad. And of course, we just talked about the political crisis in Iraq, where they're also a party to destabilizing that government through its Shia militias. So this is the question for you. Do you think that the Iran deal was worth it, given that it's only a 10 to 15-year horizon with respect to containing its nuclear program?
Yeah, I think I had I got it.
Okay.
Yes, is the answer to that question, because it's not just a 15-year horizon, first of all. Iran, in that agreement, signed the agreement saying they would never build a nuclear weapon, ever. So it goes beyond that. There are many different layers to it. And second of all, you know, it was but one piece of the Iranian problem. You know, made no bones about that at the time. But Iran with a nuclear weapon is vastly worse than Iran without one. So, you know, we have now gotten a deal, an agreement that is going to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Does that mean that they're not doing a whole lot of other bad stuff? Certainly doesn't. Yes, there are many, many other issues that we have to deal with Iran on. But stopping the nuclear program has been a huge priority, you know, not just for us, but for Israel, for the Arab allies. So that is how I judge the agreement, is on its ability to stop that program.
Then with respect to its other activities, as you said, that's very important to have contained the nuclear program. But do you think the United States, this government and perhaps the subsequent government, has the political will to keep holding Iran accountable, not just on the nuclear deal, but also with respect to these nefarious activities in the region, which are certainly problematic for the Sunni Gulf allies, insofar as they're going to receive billions of dollars in sanctions relief? And there's the concern that this money will be used to continue these destabilizing activities. To what extent do you think the United States should do more to prevent or to, again, sanction Iran somehow?
We are sanctioning Iran. That was the other thing about the nuclear deal. It did not remove all the sanctions from Iran. There are still many sanctions in place. I support keeping them there and expanding them if Iran continues this behavior. We are in the process of negotiating an upgraded defense relationship with Israel. We continue to work with Saudi Arabia and other Arab allies. We absolutely need to be committed and remain committed and even expand that commitment to stopping the aggression from Iran, and we are. And I support that very strongly.
Well, you say we are. That leads me to ask you a question about Syria, because, again, in Syria, a part of the problem there is Iran's aggressive support of Hezbollah and, of course, the Syrian regime, Bashar al-Assad, both of whom are attacking the rebel opposition whom
we
support.
Look, it's a big mess. There isn't any question about that. And it's a big mess because of lack of governance, because of the Sunni-Shia split. And, you know, it's a powder keg. And it's not going to stop being a powder, no matter who's president. I guess Donald Trump has promised to solve all problems, so if he gets elected, I guess we've got nothing to worry about. But, you know, aside from that miracle coming to pass, you know, we are going to have a challenge in the Middle East. The Sunni-Shia split, the terrible governance. I mean, Assad is an illegitimate ruler. And, you know, many people are taking advantage of that. You know, Daesh is taking advantage of that. But his governance is what led to this extremist backlash. And, you know, that's going to continue to be a challenge, and we're going to have to continue to work to try to contain it. But there's no simple solution. The divisions, the religious divisions in that region make it very difficult, you know, in Iraq and Syria, as we have seen. But, you know, keeping the Middle East at least somewhat under control is a U.S. interest, and we need to be involved and part of that in an intelligent way.
Of course, another country that's part of creating chaos, but on the other hand is sometimes seen as a potential partner for resolving problems, is Russia. You mentioned Russia, of course, on the world stage after invading eastern Ukraine, after annexing Crimea, which has really upended the post World War II order, and now coming in last September to buck up the regime of Bashar al-Assad, again causing chaos against the rebel opposition, the civilians, helping to create this very unfortunate migrant flow, refugee crisis in Europe. How do you see the United States-Russia relationship going forward? Should we be more careful about how we deal with Putin's Russia, more aggressive perhaps? What are your thoughts?
Basically, you know, I think we need to make it clear that we're going to support our allies in Eastern Europe, and we've done that. We have the Eastern European Partnership, which has committed money and troops to shore up that region to, you know, let Russia know that we are still standing firm, that NATO's not going anywhere. And then, you know, we have to sort of slowly continue to work with Russia in a way that hopefully gets them to understand that a zero-sum Cold War game approach doesn't, I mean, look at the Russian economy. It's in shambles. I mean, they you know, the price of oil is going down. They have not built a proper economy. They should be focused on that. They should be focused on working with the Western world, not trying to get into a zero-sum game. And ultimately, I think that's why Putin's done what he's done. He couldn't provide for his people at home, so he's trying to create a foreign enemy to justify his leadership. And that's dangerous. It's incredibly dangerous, and I know that. And part of containing that danger is to show him that he can't get away with it, to have that strong support. That's why, you know, Mac Thornberry and I, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, have worked together. We think we should be giving more aid to the Ukraine to stop what Russia is doing, to make it clear that they can't simply come in and take over the eastern part of the Ukraine without paying a steep price for it. So we're going to have to block them in the short term while continuing dialogue about where we might be able to work together. They have been helpful to us in some ways in Afghanistan. Syria, I don't know that they have been helpful. What they're simply trying to do is prop up Assad. They've claimed otherwise. They've claimed that they're there to fight Daesh. But it seems to be rather clear that they're simply there to prop up Assad. And as long as Assad is in power, Daesh will continue. His illegitimacy as a ruler gives them a great recruiting and propaganda tool.
Let me now turn to my colleague for another question.
Looking at Donald Trump's anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant language that he's used on the campaign trail, you know, the international audience is very concerned that this reflects a larger opinion on the part of the American public that they haven't been able to express up until now, until Donald Trump has become the presumptive Republican nominee. What would you say to them about that issue and what it reflects about political discussion here in the United States?
Well, I think it's very, very dangerous. You know, look, in order to be successful in our fight against Daesh, we need Muslim allies. You know, we need to make it clear that in the United States of America, we are a multicultural, diverse society that is accepting of all faiths and all belief systems, and that's what makes us great, whereas Daesh wants to kill everybody who doesn't think exactly like them. To the extent that we push away Muslims, deny access for refugees, talk about, you know, not allowing them to come into this country, that simply feeds into the extremist narrative. The extremist narrative being that the West is at war with Islam. We are not. We are working with many Muslim countries throughout the world. And in our country, I have a very large Muslim population in my district. They are very strong members of our community. They are, you know, educating their children. They are involved in businesses. You know, we need to strengthen those bonds, not tear them apart. Because again, just like with Iran pushing the Sunnis away from Baghdad, you know, if we push Muslims away from the United States, that only encourages the extremist views that threaten us.
So you don't think Donald Trump speaks for most Americans, then?
I do not. You know, there may be a minority of people who feel that extreme and that angry about this, but it is only a minority. He certainly doesn't speak for my constituents, I can tell you that.
Congressman Smith, I want to turn to a topic that's dear to your heart, and that's the topic of immigration reform. We've tried and failed, that is, for comprehensive immigration reform, but we have the executive actions of President Obama, which I know you support. Do you see immigration reform going anywhere in a positive direction in the coming years?
Not with this Congress. Unfortunately, we are too divided. I think if they'd brought comprehensive immigration reform up for a vote, it had a majority of votes. But the Republicans controlling the House, they didn't allow it to come up for a vote. We need a more sensible immigration system. I think immigration is one of the great strengths of our society. And I think part of that is we need a pathway to citizenship for the undocumented population. The undocumented population in, you know, every neighborhood in the country, you know, there are people there who are undocumented, who are working, raising a family, paying taxes, part of our community. We need to give them a pathway to citizenship, and then we need a more sensible legal immigration system, because we have huge needs in that area as well. But right now we are too divided to get that to where it needs to be.
And with respect to a new administration, whoever occupies the White House as a result of our elections in November, what advice would you have on foreign and national security policy for that occupant?
No, I think any new president is going to have to understand that it's going to be about partnerships. It's going to be about finding countries that we can work together with to meet our goals. You know, the days of one country dominating the world, if there ever were such days, are gone. There have been the rise of powers all across the world. You know, India, China, certainly Russia, Brazil until recently. You know, there are a lot of countries out there that we need to seek partnerships with in order to better advance our interests and to create a more peaceful and stable world. And I think understanding the need for those partnerships is going to be critical to any foreign policy success.
Do you see trade deals as part of those partnerships? Have Obama supporting?
I do, as long as they're the right type of trade deal. If it's just a trade deal that enables a corporation to have one more place to go to, you know, pay workers less and not pay attention to the environment. Look, the workers' rights, the environmental rights, the human rights protections that are in trade agreements need to be every little bit as enforceable as the property rights. And right now they're not.
TPP.
Yeah, TPP doesn't do that. TPP gives a private right of action to businesses to sue to protect their interests. But if you want to protect workers' rights, they got to go through USTR, the United States Trade Representative, and go through a long, long process. And they're never enforced. Those things have to be on a par. Protecting workers and protecting property have to at least be equal. And in TPP, they are not.
Congressman Adam Smith is a Democrat from the state of Washington and ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for your time and terrific insights.
Hi, this is Kim Lewis, host of Africa World Tonight, inviting you to join us Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 20 UTC on The Voice of America. You'll get news you can count on, news you can use, and up-to-the-minute analysis of late-breaking developments on the continent. You'll hear informative interviews with some of Africa's biggest newsmakers, live reports from the scene, and world developments that affect Africa. Stay informed. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 20 UTC for the latest in news, sports, entertainment, and music. Africa World Tonight on The Voice of America.
Before we close, we return to Congressman Smith's response to our question about major national security threats that face the United States and the world. He cited the fight against violent extremism, particularly combating the likes of ISIS, also known as Daesh. For additional analysis regarding U.S. efforts to combat Daesh, especially in Iraq and Syria, we turn to Soner Chaptai at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and Aaron Stein of the Atlantic Council for their perspectives. First to you, Aaron Stein. Besides sending special operations forces to help local security forces, especially in Iraq, what more do you think the United States can and should do to combat Daesh?
Well, I think there's a broad-scale recognition, even amongst those who are fighting the war now against the Islamic State, of the need to cultivate more Sunni allies on the ground. And the way to do it remains the actual question. How do you go about doing that? And these special operations forces, at least from what I can understand, one of their missions, in addition to directing airstrikes, will be to try and cultivate or at least reach out to some of these local Sunni tribes to begin to at least broaden the coalition against ISIS, to widen it and to make the ground force, which is now predominantly Kurdish, more palatable for most of the people on the ground in these areas.
Well, turning to you, Soner Chaptai, clearly airstrikes alone are insufficient to defeat Daesh. So besides sending in special operations forces to help local security forces, especially in Iraq, what more do you think the United States can and should do to combat Daesh?
I think that the United States has to go at the root cause of ISIS radicalization, which is Sunni exclusion in Syria and Iraq, but specifically the war in Syria, which puts a lot of Sunnis in harm's way. And I think unless you can secure Sunni participation in the Iraqi government and the end of war in Syria, it's going to be difficult to talk about ending the root cause of radicalization of some Sunni Muslims in Iraq and Syria towards ISIS.
Well, you can hear more from Aaron Stein and Soner Chaptai on this week's Encounter, where we discuss what's behind Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's increasing grip on power. That's Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Gary Jaffe. And joining me on the program was VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.